So this is Ivar Jacobson. Well, in Sweden, they call me Ivar Jacobson. And you're listening to the Edgar Uprising Podcast.
Greetings, everyone, and welcome to another edition of the Agile Uprising Podcast. I'm this week's host, Jay Hursko, and the topic of this week's conversation is use cases. So all of our Agile practitioners, all of us know that one of the first things we learn is how to write a user story. As an Agile Uprising podcaster, I want listeners to listen to our show so that they can gain some knowledge. But we all know that this is also fraught with difficulty, and sometimes it turns into a very painful teaching point. And let's be honest here, in the intent of making things quick and streamlined, we almost lose some detail. So what about use cases? What about, I know that's a bit heretical to say that word because it harkens back to the days of waterfall, but what if there's a way to use use cases in our current Agile environments to actually make ourselves more successful and to spend that little extra 5 minutes documenting things like non-functionals, documenting other ways that this request could be used so that we can deliver better value. And to discuss use cases, I have the actual father of use cases itself, Ivar Jacobson, with us, and we're going to talk through it. So Ivar, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
And it is a pleasure to have you. So Ivar, in case some of our listeners don't know who you are, could you give us just a brief bio, a brief introduction, who you are, how you came to get into the use case world?
Well, I have had two careers, at the least. One is an industrial and the other is an academic. Of course, most of the time I've spent has been in the industry. And the use case idea came up when I worked at Ericsson. This is many years ago, 1986 to be more exact. At that time, specifications and requirements were written in the form of big documents called something like functional specification or functional requirements. And people used special notation to describe them. There were structured analysis was one of very popular methods to do requirements. The problem with all these was that you lost the user in it. It became very hard to understand how all these functions would make up something useful. And so at that time, I started to think about it from a different point of view, namely from a user. So for each user or user type, you identify what are the things that the system should do for that user type. And I call them use cases. Actually, from the beginning, since it was in Swedish, the Swedish word for it was användningsfall. But if I translated that to English, it would be usage case. And that was too hard for me to pronounce, so I decided to take away a couple of letters. So that was a simple idea that actually took on quite quickly. I wrote a book about it. 1992 was the book published, and it became very successful quite immediately. So that was basically what the background from how I came to it. Yeah.
Okay, so Ivar, let me ask you this. In comparison to some of us who are used to, I mean, I came from the waterfall world, so I was very, very familiar with using use cases. And obviously in the Agile ecosystem, I'm familiar with user stories. You just introduced use case 2.0. So can you explain to us what that is?
Well, it means basically that the use cases are for a software system are quite big. It may be for large system requiring man-years to develop, many man-years to develop, you may need, you usually have even 10 use cases is a large system. So that means that they are not something you work with in an iteration or in a sprint. So when we had an approach to do, to implement a one slice of a use case, but it was not formalized. We didn't have a formal concept of it. We just recommended people to do it like that. In 2005, I worked on a new book. Actually, it was published in 2005, called Aspect-Oriented Software Development with Use Cases. And then we came up with a concept of slicing. A slice is basically one a meaningful path through a use case. So typically, a use case has a normal path, let's say a happy day path, and that is a very good candidate to make a slice. In some cases, this is too big for one backlog item. So you may have to slice it again in some smart way. Then there are many alternative paths. You may, if you, for instance, use an ATM machine, you may have the wrong PIN code, and that is a typical candidate for a slice. And as you see, these slices are similar to stories. So we actually, a slice is typically one or more stories, user stories.
And that's when you just said that, Ivor, you said that remark, a meaningful path. That's the first thing that jumped in my head is if I'm thinking of a use case, it is a bucket of value, right? And then yes. Your meaningful path, your slices really are user stories.
Yes. Exactly. They are the great thing about them is that you know what you need to slice. You have a bigger, meaningful, useful element, the use case that you want to give to a user. So when you slice it, you know where you want when you have done it. You know when you have found all slices. That is one of the contributions of user stories. When you invent user stories, where is the end of it? How many of them make up something meaningful, completely meaningful? So use cases and user stories are very good, work very well together. And in use case 2.0, we have integrated the user story idea in these slices. And slice is something you run with in a sprint. And you can slice a slice in more time so you get the reasonable size of them.
One of the things, Ivor, honestly, that jumped out at me is often when we author user stories, we'll run through, okay, well, I need X, I need Y, I need Z. And I think one of the things that gets lost, my personal feeling observation, is when I used to do use cases, I would talk about not only, you brought it up early, the happy path, but the unhappy path. Yes. And sometimes I think, if I'm going to be a bit philosophical, in our quest for speed and our quest for deliver value, better, faster, quicker, cheaper, we forget about the fact that what happens when things go wrong. And when you sent me some of your materials around use case 2.0 and I started to get my head back around it, I thought that this could be a very, very helpful tool for teams that not to, to make them think about the things that happen when it's the unhappy path. Because nothing worse than saying, if you're in a safe shop, I finished this feature, I finished this epic. And then realizing that what happens when a user doesn't use it in a way that I intended, even with the customer sitting right next to you. So I think to me, one of the interesting selling points is it forces you to use cases, don't force you to think about what happens when something goes wrong.
Yes, absolutely.
So with this new use case 2.0, I know you're reintroducing this concept. So what would be, if someone comes from the waterfall world and they've done use cases and then they went full bore into the agile world, right? And now they're used to the user stories. And now we're trying to reintroduce use cases as use case 2.0. What are some of the big changes? What are some of the features, Ivor, that you'd want to point out to say, hey, these are some of the things that we've changed use cases to make them more, to make them a better fit to the Agile world?
Yeah, at this, the introduction of a use case slice as a first-class citizen in the development. And they, once you have identified the use case, that is where you start. So assume you have not, you've used user stories, but not used use cases. What does it mean for you to complement what you're doing with use cases? It doesn't mean you throw away anything you have, not at all. You just start with making a use case model, and that is something, particularly if you already know what user stories are, you will maybe start with a storming meeting, and people come up with what are the things, who are the users, and what are the use cases, and you draw a nice picture, which is very easy to draw. And once you have identified the use cases, you start for look for stories that this use case consists of. And there is a systematic way of doing it. You start to draw, identify the happy day scenario, and then you hang on to this happy day scenario. Alternative paths. And exception paths. And once you have made this picture, which is quite easy to do, you have your user stories. So and now you can attach your user stories. If you already have a system with a lot of user stories, you can go through each and every one of them and mark them to which use case they belong. And you have a big picture and you have the details and you can easily present what you have to clients and to marketing and to all kinds of developers at different levels in the organization.
So one of the terms you just used, Ivor, jumped out at me. It's the usage of the term big picture. And I think in my experience, as an Agile coach, I think that's one of the places I consistently hear feedback is with all these very granular pieces of value, it's very hard sometimes to wrap your head around the actual overall deliverable, the overall capability that I'm trying to do, which is where I think use cases do come in handy. And to bootstrap off what you just said, you talked about a storming meeting, which is typically how most projects or programs or even initiatives, ideas start. You get a bunch of people in a room and you start rattling off ideas. Technically, you could even, a team that's currently functioning today using user stories, they could back themselves into use cases by almost doing what amounts to a user story map to create adjacencies. And then, okay, well, this all bumps up under one use case. Am I wrong on that statement?
No, absolutely right. You could do that. So story mapping is something that has been basically introduced thanks to user stories. But it works very well with use cases. And actually, if you do it the proper way with use cases, you really don't need story mapping. But it may contribute something to some teams. I'm always very careful to express myself too dogmatic. you learned that if you have been working in this industry in the methodology space for many years, you know that there is so many truths to a given problem.
Very true. Very true. Ivor, I wanted to ask you, so when we say the term use case, obviously the first knee-jerk reaction from your Agile dogmatist is going to be, well, we're going back now to the old days where we got to document everything up front. But it sounds to me that you're actually saying, don't do it all up front, make passes and slices through it. Is that correct?
Absolutely, yes. Basically, you don't even make the whole use case model up front. You start with the use cases that you really care about in the first sprints. And you build the model as you go. There is very little upfront design, and not more than so you really can get started. You have a big picture from day one that you then change as time goes by. Now, when it comes to documentation, people did far too much documentation. We never suggested so much documentation when it came to use cases, but we were not clear about it. We didn't identify in a very clear way what level of documentation you need. So in this new use cases, we have a level of detail. So for every document, every kind of thing you want to document, say the use case model, or say a use case as such, there is three or four levels of documentation you can take, because some projects require very little documentation, and some projects require a lot of documentation. For instance, life-threatening software. Software that has to work, otherwise it can be critical for life. We have then four different levels. For instance, the first level is just an outline, just this description of a big picture of that use case or that use case model. But then you can go down into any detail. You can even have flow charts to describe the use case. But that is at one extreme. So documentation is something we have paid significant interest to. And actually, we are relying on a new standard that we have applied. The ESSEN standard for identifying what is the essence of anything software engineering. What is the essence of a use case? What is the essence of using use case modeling and so on? And that helps us to keep the level of documentation very low if that is what is required.
Right. It almost, to use a term that gets used a lot and beaten up, honestly, in the Agile ecosystem, it's almost making you think about what we call an MVP, or what would be termed as an MVP.
Don't
write everything up front, but start thinking about what is the most important piece you have to deliver. And I talked about this early on, Ivor. I think, again, when I think about use cases, the big benefit of using this for me, even in especially in an Agile world, is your non-functional requirements. The things that when you write a story using the typical syntax, you may be likely to forget, you know, your illities, reliability, scalability, usability. These are all things that are part of that template, which force you to think about them. Where I have seen a lot of times in my career where teams will go off and start actually building a user story, and they won't take those things into account because they have this almost laser focus on what is the value being delivered, not realizing that there are things that make that value, gratuitous air quotes, go. And I think that's where some teams actually run, they paint themselves into a corner.
Yes, that is correct. We use cases has always had served as a placeholder for non-functional requirements. Typically, for instance, if you make a transaction, if it's a bank transaction, the number of simultaneously instances of that transaction is often very critical. The response time of that transaction is very critical, and so on. So many of the non-functional requirements can actually be described as use case specific. There are, of course, more general non-functional requirements, but compared to the use case specific requirements, they are fewer. For instance, when I say more general requirements, non-functional requirements, I talk about we are going to run on Microsoft PC, Microsoft Windows, or we are going to run it on that platform. We are going to use this programming language and so on. So these are generic requirements. But otherwise, most other non-functional requirements are specific for a particular use case. So it helps to have it described once and for all for one use case.
Right. It's, and I've noticed that if I'm working on a couple of user stories, or I'm working with a team that's working on a couple of user stories in the same general vicinity, they have to then recreate those NFRs in every single story. It gets to be a little bit, we add more overhead by doing it in small, tiny slices, as opposed to writing a use case that will contain all of that reference information. You write it once, everybody agrees upon it, you can move on.
Absolutely, yes.
So I have a question for you. So a lot of our listeners are in environments that are scaling. I know that's a bit of a loose verb. And a lot of them, we've had feedback that a lot of our listeners actually do use the Scaled Agile Framework, or they're doing some type of scaling in their organization. So how does this approach sort of fit in some of the activities that maybe SAFe prescribes, along the ideas of epics and features and decomposition? Where do you see use cases inserting themselves in a way to really be beneficial?
So use cases is a different way of doing it, but quite closely related compared to what is originally advocated. Now, many people, my company is probably one of the most successful implementers of SAFe. we have in the company one fellow, SAFe fellow. We have three SPCTs, and we have many SPCs. So people, we train a lot of people in SAFe, and we also do consulting. Many of our clients are using use cases and use case 2.0. And it is more supportive for building large software systems than user stories and epics are. So it fits very well into SAFe.
Awesome. So another thing I wanted to ask you, Ivor, is if people want to learn more about this, I know we've talked about websites and you've sent me some materials. If people want to dig in, like what is the best way that they can get started to start poking around at this stuff to get their head wrapped around
it? So we have, since early this year, we have worked with one of the big bank in the US and developed an e-learning package on use case 2.0. It has been very successful implemented. We have a case study coming out very soon. We have developed a website for use cases where we collect anything that may be of interest to people interested in use cases. So if they come to our website, they will find it, and I can actually provide you with links. So
perfect.
People can get dig deeper into use cases in general, but also to use case 2.0. And of course, they can find out how they can get access to this e-learning class we have.
Well, great. And one of the things you brought up earlier, Ivor, that I do want to sort of dance around. I don't want to go into it too detail because I want to have you back on to discuss this specifically. But you talked about the essence standard. So we sort of flew by that. Can you give our users a little bit more background of what essence is, a little bit more detail on the standard? And like I said, we're going to have you back on because I want to talk about that and CMAT and the methods prison. But just to give our users a little bit more background, can you go into essence in a little bit of detail?
Yes. In 2003, we had, in my company, developed a methodology that would compete with the other Agile scaled agile frameworks. And not, I don't mean specifically SAFe, but SAFe would be one of them. But we were fed up, in particular myself, by this methodology wars. We were fed up by having gurus that people relied on. And the guru that decides which practices are useful and not useful and so on. We felt it's much better if we can identify an ecosystem which includes eventually all interesting practices, and their client or team can select the practices they like and compose them and get the methodology that they think fit their team. In 2003, I, instead of going the path of having another methodology to work with scaling agile, we took the path to identify what is it that is common for all these methodology we have out there today. What is common? What is the common ground? And then if we identified that common ground, we could then describe any practices on top of it. And that is what we did. So in 2014, we got this standard, and hundreds of people have been working on it. It's now adopted by many organizations, many universities are teaching it. A new book is coming out in a couple of weeks, and it will make it easy for teams to select what works for them, instead of taking a canned methodology, which is, we know that eventually any canned methodology will be replaced by something new.
Right, right. And one of the things that, I'm sorry, Ivor, I didn't mean to cut you off, but you sent me an article which talks about Essence, and I think it was an actual blog post by Jeff Sutherland talking about Scrum practices. And I will put a link in the show notes for all of our listeners. But this is a real life example of what Ivor is talking about. And it boils down Scrum to its basis parts in a way that helps you understand it. And I sent you this, Ivor, via email. I actually shared this with a couple of people inside my organization. The response was great. A lot of people were really, really into it. So you're basically trying to boil down the whole essence of what it's essence, right? Pardon the pun there, but you're trying to boil down practices into something that's almost a baseline that's universally agreed upon, which, like you said, methods come and go, and we're going to go into that in a different show in more detail about gurus and gatekeepers, but it's a simple way for everybody to get universal understanding.
Yes, that is absolutely true. We have given up okay, let me say like this. Any methodologist has to invent something new that is really makes a difference. But then they borrow material from the rest of the world, and that's fine. But the problem is, since they have come up with a completely new way of describing methods. They have come up with our own homegrown way of describing a method. And to incorporate anything from outside the world, this world, they have to rewrite it so it fits into this selected framework, selected by the guru. And that is disturbing to every other methodologist. So I'm pretty sure that if one method, like say SAFe, if it borrows something from outside world and has to re-describe it, the original author, the original developer of that practice, say Scrum, will feel that it's not exactly what they have intended. And there may also have been misunderstandings and so on. So that's how we create this methods war that started 50 years ago, more than 50 years ago, and still continues. Instead, what I would like to see is that all these bright people, they contribute that what they have, and that is then put into this ecosystem that we are developing now. We, for instance, Jeff Sutherland, Scott Ambler, and others involved in doing it. And there will be no big methods war. There may always be a war between different practices, but not the big methods, not frameworks. I think that is a sign of a mature industry, which we are far from right now. But we are getting there.
I think that is the money quote of this interview, Ivor. I want to end on that note because I think that's actually a perfect summation. But I want to give you a chance to share any upcoming events you may have. Where, if our listeners want to learn more, where can they find you? Where can they contact you? And I know I'm going to put a bunch of show notes in the show notes. I'll have a bunch of links to some of your materials. But if users want to find more, or they want to contact you, where do they go?
They are welcome to contact me directly with my email address. They can also contact and go to our website. They will find a lot there. Just now, we are just days away from a new book coming out titled The Essentials of Modern Software Engineering. It's a book that has got contributions from more than 50 university professors. The book is intended for first-year students in software engineering. But it's my hope that even if you're experienced, you will love to read this book because you see what you already know in a a more simplistic way, more structured. It will feel that it's more understandable. So this book is just days away from publication. And I think I said the title, but the title is The Essentials of Modern Software Engineering.
Ivor, that sounds great. And I look forward to getting my own copy so we can have you back on to discuss it. So to wrap us up, on behalf of the Agile Uprising Group, Ivor, I'd like to thank you. I'd like to sincerely thank you for taking your time out from the beautiful scenic Alps to talk with us today. On behalf of Ivor and myself, I'd like to thank all of our listeners once again for joining, for tuning in, for giving us a chance. There will be a thread posted on the Agile Uprising Coalition website to discuss this episode in the future. As far as upcoming episodes, one of the new features we're trying to introduce for our listeners is talking about what episodes are coming up. We have a whole slew of episodes we just recorded at Mile High Agile. We're going to be slow rolling them out. We have another discussion coming up on empirical thinking and empirical thought processes of research, and we have a couple of group panel conversations coming up, one of which is going to be around using the 12 principles of the manifesto as driving metrics for your successful transformation. So we'll get into that more. Once again, Ivor, I want to thank you. I want to thank all of our listeners. And until next time, this is the Agile Uprising signing out.
Thank you.